Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2, for the record, program number 707, Update on Eurofascism. This program has been recorded on March 28th of the year 2010. We're going to launch right in where we left off at the conclusion of the discussion on Side 1. We've been talking about Swedish fascism. We've been talking about its history of association with the Third Reich and with a prominent Third Reich personalities. We've been talking about Per Engdahl, the arguably the most prominent organized political fascist in Sweden, and his role in helping to perpetuate European fascism from the World War II period to today. And in particular, we've been talking about the deep underbelly of Swedish society in which powerful fascist entrepreneurs, doubling with, among others, the Swedish intelligence service and so-called neo-Nazis, have forged an engine in which there is a truly insidious criminal underworld in Sweden that involves some brutal sex practices against women, slave prostitution, kiddie porn, organ harvesting, and some truly horrible things, which in turn are manifestations of the fascist underground in Sweden. And again, we should note in passing that the operatives used in these types of activities are sanctioned by some of the most powerful elements in Sweden, and that some of the slave sex trafficking that goes through Sweden necessarily has to involve the immigration department in Sweden. The former Swedish immigration minister was Barbro Holmberg, Tiger Woods' mother-in-law, and an individual who obviously has to have had some dealings with the underground Reich, Sweden having become something of a haven for war criminals. Now, we were talking about Stig Larsson, who dropped dead on November 9th of 2004. There was a good article about Stig Larsson, although I think his final conclusions are, well, predictable for Christopher Hitchens, who doesn't want to be tarred with the conspiracy genre. But nonetheless, it's a very, as is generally the case with Christopher Hitchens, a very well-written article. He's arguably, he's one of the most skilled wordsmiths writing in English today, and it has some very significant disclosures about the world that Stig Larsson was discussing. In this article, it's called The Author Who Played with Fire by Christopher Hitchens. It was in the December 2009 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. And skipping down, talking about Sweden, yet it is from this society of reassuring brand names and womb-to-tomb national healthcare that Stig Larsson conjured a detective double act so incongruous that it makes Holmes and Watson seem like siblings. I say conjured because Mr. Larsson also drew upon the bloody, haunted old Sweden of trolls and elves and ogres, and I put it in the past tense because, just as the first book in his Millennium Trilogy, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, was about to make his fortune, he very suddenly became a dead person. In the Larsson universe, the nasty trolls and hulking ogres are bent Swedish capitalists, cold-faced Baltic sex traffickers, blue-eyed Viking Aryan Nazis and other Nordic riffraff who might have had their reasons to whack him. But if he now dwells in that Valhalla of the hack writer who posthumously beat all the odds, it's surely because of his elf. Picture a feral waif. All right, picture a 4-foot-11-inch doll, unquote, with Asperger's syndrome and generous breast implants. This is not Pippi Longstocking, to whom a few gestures are made in the narrative. This is Miss Goth, intermittently disguised as La Gamine. This is Lisbeth Salander, the character who works with Blomqvist, the detective, and she's sort of surreal. She's a computer whiz and all kinds of other things. Bear in mind, this is fiction, but what is significant here is the extent to which this fiction was simply a literary portrayal of political and social realities, which were too controversial and, for some of the people involved, too deadly to be spoken about. Skipping down in Hitchens' article, with all these superheroine advantages, one wonders why she and her on-off sidekick, the lumbering but unstoppable reporter Michael Blomqvist, don't defeat the forces of Swedish fascism and imperialism more effortlessly. But the other reason that Lisbeth Salander is such a source of fascination is this. The pint-sized minxoid with the dragon tattoo is also a traumatized victim and doesn't work or play well with others. She has been raped and tortured and otherwise abused ever since she could think, and her private phrase for her coming of age is, all the evil, words that go unelucidated until near the end of The Girl Who Played with Fire. The actress Noomi Rapace has already played Salander in a Swedish film of the first novel, which enjoyed a worldwide release. When Hollywood gets to the casting stage, I suppose Philip Seymour Hoffman will be offered the Ursine Blomqvist role, and though the coloring is wrong, I keep thinking of Winona Ryder for Lisbeth. According to Larson's father, the sympathy with which the girl is evoked is derived partly from the author's own beloved niece Therese, who is tattooed and has suffered from anorexia and dyslexia but can fix your computer problems. In life, Stieg Larsson described himself as, among other things, a feminist, and his character surrogate, Michael Blomqvist, the reporter, takes an ostentatiously severe line against the male domination of society and indeed of his own profession. The original grim and Swedish title of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is Men Who Hate Women, while the trilogy's third book bore the more fairy tale-like name The Castle in the Air That Blew Up. The clever rebranding of the series with the word girl on every cover was obviously critical. Blomqvist's moral righteousness comes in very useful for the action of the novels because it allows the depiction of a great deal of cruelty to women smuggled through customs under the disguise of a strong disapproval. Sweden used to be notorious in the late 1960s as the homeland of the film I Am Curious Yellow, which went all the way to the Supreme Court when distributed in the United States, and gave Sweden a world reputation as a place of smiling nudity and guilt-free sex. What a world of nursery innocence that was, compared with the child slavery and exploitation that are evoked with perhaps slightly too much relish by the crusading Blomqvist. His best excuse for his own prurience is that these serial killers and torture fanciers are practicing a form of capitalism and that their racket is protected by a pornographic alliance with a form of fascism, its lower ranks made up of hideous bikers and meth runners. This is not just sex or a crime, it's politics. Most of the time, Larson hauls himself along with writing such as this. The murder investigation was like a broken mosaic in which he could make out some pieces while others were simply missing. Somewhere, there was a pattern. He could sense it, but he could not figure it out. Too many pieces were missing. No doubt there were, or there would be no book. The plot of the first story is so heavily convoluted it requires a page reproducing the Wanger dynasty's family tree, the first time I can remember encountering such a dramatis personae since I read War and Peace. But when he comes to the villain of The Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, a many-tentacled tycoon named Wennerström, Larson's prose is suddenly much more spirited. Wennerström has consecrated himself to, quote, fraud that was so extensive, it was no longer merely criminal, it was business, unquote. That's actually one of the best-turned lines in the whole 1,000 pages. If it sounds a bit like Bertolt Brecht on an average day, it's because Larson's own views are old-shoe communist. His background involved the unique bonding that comes from tough red families and solid class loyalties. The hard labor and factory and mining sector of Sweden is in the far and arduous north. This is also the home territory of most of the country's storytellers, and Grandpa was a proletarian communist up toward the Arctic. This during the Second World War, when quite a few Swedes were volunteering to serve Hitler's new order and join the SS. In a note, the 23-year-old Larson wrote before setting out for Africa, he bequeathed everything to the Communist Party of his hometown, Umeå. The ownership of the immense later fortune that he never saw went by law to his father and brother, leaving his partner of 30 years, Eva Gabrielsson, with no legal claim, only a moral one that asserts she alone is fit to manage Larson's very lucrative legacy. And this is not the only murk that hangs around his death at the age of 50 in 2004. To be exact, Stieg Larsson died on November 9th, 2004, which I can't help noticing was the anniversary of Kristallnacht. And parenthetically, it's the anniversary of a whole lot more than that. November 9th is a very significant date for the Nazi movement. By the way, in the Nazi novel The Turner Diaries, which has been the blueprint for the Nazi terror group The Order in the 1980s, financed, according to one of its members, by German, quote, families, unquote, in Latin America. We know who that is. But also the model for Timothy McVeigh and company, and he was far more than a lone nut. And the climactic episode of The Turner Diaries is a low-level suicide aerial attack on the Pentagon, which takes place in the novel on November 9th, 1993. By the way, a German or any other European, for that matter, would write the date November 9th, 9/11. Think about that one. Returning again to Christopher Hitchens' article. To be exact, Stieg Larsson died on November 9th, 2004, which I can't help noticing was the anniversary of Kristallnacht. Is it plausible that Sweden's most public anti-Nazi just chanced to expire from natural causes on such a date? Larsson's magazine Expo, which has a fairly clear fictional cousinhood with Millennium, was an unceasing annoyance to the extreme right. He himself was the public figure most identified with the unmasking of white supremacist and neo-Nazi organizations, many of them with a hard-earned reputation for homicidal violence. The Swedes are not the Pacific herbivores that many people imagine. In the footnotes to his second novel, Larsson reminds us that Prime Minister Olof Palme was gunned down in the street in 1986, and that the Foreign Minister Anna Lind was stabbed to death in a Stockholm department store in 2003. The first crime is still unsolved, and the verdict in the second case has by no means satisfied everybody. By the way, I don't think it's in the archives, but we have spoken about the assassination of Olof Palme. He was trying to shut down some aspects of the weapons trade that was going to Iraq and Iran, and residual Croatian fascist elements have been implicated in that killing, which again officially remains unsolved. Continuing with Christopher Hitchens' article, a report in the mainstream newspaper Aftonbladet describes the findings of another anti-Nazi researcher named Bosse Schön, who unraveled a plot to murder Stieg Larsson that included a Swedish SS veteran. Another scheme misfired because on the night in question 20 years ago, he saw skinheads with bats waiting outside his office and left by the rear exit. Websites are devoted to further speculation. One blog is preoccupied with the theory that Prime Minister Palme's uncaught assassin was behind the death of Larsson, too. Larsson's name and other details were found when the Swedish police searched the apartment of a fascist arrested for a political murder. Larsson's address, telephone number, and photograph, along with threats to people identified as, quote, enemies of the white race, unquote, were published in a neo-Nazi magazine. The authorities took it seriously enough to prosecute the editor. But Larsson died of an apparent coronary thrombosis, not from any mayhem. So he would have had to be poisoned, say, or somehow medically murdered. Such an hypothesis would point to some involvement high up, unquote. And anyone who has read the novels will know that in Larsson's world, the forces of law and order in Sweden are fettedly complicit with organized crime. And also, I would note, with neo-Nazis, and certainly the Swedish intelligence service, like any intelligence service, or any organized crime syndicate worth the name, would have the means of killing somebody in such a way as to make it look like a heart attack or other natural means. Continuing with Christopher Hitchens' analysis, so did he, Larsson, wind up, in effect, a character in one of his own tales? The people who might have the most interest in keeping the speculation alive, his publishers and publicists, choose not to believe it. 60 cigarettes a day plus tremendous amounts of junk food and coffee and an enormous workload, says Christopher McLehose, Larsson's literary discoverer in English and by a nice coincidence a publisher of Flashman, quote, would be the culprit. I guess he'd even had a warning heart murmur. Still, I have attended demonstrations by these Swedish right-wing thugs, and they are truly frightening. I also know someone with excellent contacts in the Swedish police and security world who assures me that everything described in his Millennium novels actually took place. And apparently, Larsson planned to write as many as 10 in all, so you can see how people might think that he might not have died but been, quote, stopped, unquote. Well, yes, indeed. Certainly a bad lifestyle will kill you eventually, and Larsson certainly appears to have had that. But again, there are a lot of people who've been very abusive of their health who live to be considerably older than Stieg Larsson and don't die of heart attacks on the anniversary of the Kristallnacht. Again, noting that Christopher Hitchens does note that if, in fact, Larsen was stopped, it would have involved people, quote, higher up. Well, there's been no shortage of those. We were talking about the links between the moving now from Sweden to other parts of Europe. We noted the connections between Swedish Nazis and the Swedish intelligence service. A very disturbing fact concerns the new head of MI6, British Foreign Intelligence. His half-brother is an assistant and researcher for none other than David Irving. And David Irving is a Holocaust denier and someone very close to the European fascist milieu. This article is from the Daily Mail of the United Kingdom, July 5th of 2009. MI6 chief blows his cover as wife's Facebook account reveals family holidays, showbiz friends, and links to David Irving. Skipping down, we see, among those featured in family photographs on the website is Lady Sauer's half-brother, Hugo Haig Thomas, a former diplomat. Lady Sauer's met her husband after visiting her brother when he was posted to Yemen in the late 70s. She liked the country and decided to stay, landing a secretarial job at the embassy where Sir John later succeeded Mr. Haig Thomas. Mr. Haig Thomas is an associate and researcher for revisionist historian David Irving, who was jailed for 3 years in Austria in 2006 for, quote, glorifying the Nazi Party, unquote, because he questioned whether the Holocaust took place. The historian describes Haig Thomas as a, quote, researcher who has done fine work for me, unquote. His work includes examining the papers relating to the capture of Heinrich Himmler, the man behind Hitler's plan to exterminate the European Jews. A recent post by Mr. Haig Thomas on Irving's website includes a translation of the testimony of a German officer who claimed to have built fake gas chambers at Sachsenhausen concentration camp on Soviet orders. But Mr. Haig Thomas said he had never considered his views controversial, nor did he regret his connection with Irving. That about the half-brother to the current head of British Foreign Intelligence. Doesn't sound too good, and it'll be interesting if we see an uptick in the in official expressions of British anti-Semitism, something that has always been present and that the expression of which has been increasing. A figure in the European fascist scene who's occupied a lot of space in these broadcasts over the decades, and that is Stefan Bandera, head of the OUNB, a Ukrainian fascist organization whose members were involved in sabotage on behalf of the Third Reich in the U.S., even before U.S. entry into World War II. Bandera's people collaborated with the Third Reich. They were deeply involved in the liquidation of Ukrainian Jewry. They also contributed heavily to the 14th Waffen-SS Division, the Galician Division. I noted that the head of the Bandera organization, by the way, Bandera's assassination, probably at the hands of the BND, the Galen organization, officially, however, at the hands of the KGB, that was used to help cover up the assassination of President Kennedy. A number of people, both in Congress and outside of Congress, were generating disinformation that Lee Harvey Oswald worked for the same division of Soviet intelligence as Bogdan Stashinsky, the alleged assassin, or perhaps actual assassin, of Stefan Bandera. We've talked about that in numerous broadcasts. I've noted that Bogdan Stashinsky still had the broken half of a key, the other half of which was still in the apartment in which Stefan Bandera was killed. And this was used to by the German courts to link Bogdan Stashinsky with Stefan Bandera's killing. He may very well have been the killer, but the fact that he still had one half of a key, the other half of which was broken off and still in the lock of Bandera's apartment, just doesn't pass the sniffs test. I've noted in the past that the head of the OUNB, a woman named Ekaterina Chumachenko, was head of presidential liaison under Ronald Reagan, and that reflecting the heritage of Otto von Bolschwing and also Helena von Dahm. Eventually, Ekaterina Chumachenko married Viktor Yushchenko and became Ekaterina Yushchenko, the former first lady of the Ukraine. The Ukraine under the Yushchenko-Chumachenko regime once again saw a resurgence of anti-Semitism and fascist activity. And although he has now been voted out as head of the Ukraine, I would note that one of the last acts of Viktor Yushchenko was to name Stefan Bandera a hero of the Ukraine. from the magazine Russia Today of January 30th of 2010, and the URL will be available in the description for the program, we find the following about the elevation of Stefan Bandera to being a hero of the Ukraine. The largest human rights organization in the U.S., the Simon Wiesenthal Center, joined the chorus of those who condemned the declaration of controversial nationalist leader Stefan Bandera as a hero of the Ukraine. And skipping down, and far more, by the way, as I've noted in the supplemental discussion of this, far more than Jews ought to be upset by this. Expressing his, this is Mark Weitzman, head of government affairs at the Wiesenthal Center, expressing his deepest revulsion, Weitzman also reminded that the late Simon Wiesenthal, who founded their organization, was born in the Ukraine himself. And skipping down, Bandera's supporters, mainly in the western Ukraine, claim he fought for Ukraine's independence against both Soviet and German soldiers. However, many others in his country and Russia believe he was a war criminal who collaborated with the Nazis during World War II and killed innocent people. The Federation of Russia's Jewish Communities, or FEOR, in a statement issued Monday, said Yushchenko's moves insult the memory of the victims of Nazi crimes. And skipping down, the document authors believe that such a political gesture is a challenge to the civilized world, to everyone who fought against Nazism during the Second World War. By the way, in AFA program number one, we took a look at correspondence from Frank Wisner, Deputy Director of Central Intelligence, eventually, lauding the Bandera organization's ongoing guerrilla war against the Soviets, a guerrilla warfare campaign begun under the auspices of the Third Reich and then later continued under the auspices of elements of Western intelligence, including State Department and CIA. We've taken a look at Bandera again many, many times over the years, and it's very indicative, I think, of the revisionism sweeping not only Europe but all over the world, that we now find Stefan Bandera, an active Nazi collaborator and an individual whose fascist activities span the globe, really, because he certainly, because his minions became very active in the United States and figured in, among other things, the assassination of President Kennedy. It is indeed, I think, the elevation of Stefan Bandera to being a hero of the Ukraine is indeed a challenge to the civilized world and a disgrace to the memories of those who fought against fascism. Something very similar has been happening in the Balkans, where the Croatian fascist Ustashi organization has basically been recreated in, quote, independent, unquote, Croatia. We looked at, in For the Record 701, the fact that Kosovo has basically come under the sway of the heirs to the 21st Waffen-SS, or Skanderbeg Division, and other fascist fighting formations, that is the KLA, and it's become little more than a German colony. In Bosnia, too, we've taken a look at how President Ali Izetbegovic, the late president of Bosnia, was not only an Islamist, but also an active collaborator with Bosnian Muslim fascism. He was a member of the Young Muslims in Bosnia during World War II and helped to recruit for the 13th Waffen-SS, or Hanjar Division, recruited by Haj Amin al-Husseini. A Bosnian pride movement is coalescing, which explicitly hearkens and calls to and calls up in a positive way the symbols and principles of Bosnian Islamic fascism. The following is from the Serbiana.com website. It's called Nazi Bosnian Pride Movement formed from February 19th of 2009. Bosnian neo-Nazi organization was birthed today that insists that Bosnia belongs to the Bosniaks, an invented nationality with which Bosnian Muslims identify in order to avoid their religious background when talking to the Western press. The new Nazi Bosnian Pride Movement believes that Serbs and Croats have no right to the state and that the state belongs exclusively to Bosnian Muslims, a.k.a. Bosniaks. The Nazi Bosnian Pride Movement has expanded its enemy list from their World War II predecessors, the Hanjar Division and the Young Muslims. And their symbol explicitly involves the swastika. So again, the revisionism and revival of fascism and Nazism around Europe continues apace. In For the Record 677, we took a look at the very real possibility that revisionists and Nazi sympathizers would be elected again in Austria. We find the following. This is an article from it's from an AP story from the Google website, and it is from March 3rd of 2010. Austria's largest daily endorses Nazi revisionist candidate, reads in part, "A woman who was criticized on anti-Nazi law and is married to an extreme rightist is running for president in Austria, and critics contend her candidacy could tarnish the reputation of a country still marred by its connection to the Holocaust." And her name is Barbara Rosenkrantz. And by the way, we are running low on time, so I'm simply going to touch on some of the remaining stories. These stories will be in their fullest in the description too, for the record 707. And many of them are available in the aforementioned Food for Thought and News and Supplemental sections. The Spiegel Online, one of the major German publications of March 11th of 2010, noted the following: "The Eichmann Files, classified documents could be released after 50 years, a story by Leon Disha-Becker. And this concerns the fact that the BND, the German intelligence service, has decided to keep its files on Eichmann classified for 50 more years. This on a man who died in 1961. The speculation officially circulated is that it would compromise the BND's relationship with another intelligence service. Critics have noted all they have to do is to redact any parts of the documents that refer to the Foreign Intelligence Service, and that in all probability it is because prominent German officials and the Vatican aided in Eichmann's flight. And there's discussion here of the book The Real Odessa by Uki Goni, talking about how basically it appears that German officials not only helped Eichmann to escape, but also helped many of his subordinates to escape as well. By the way, I made an allusion to Helena von Damm and Otto von Bolschwing. Otto von Bolschwing, whose protege Helena von Damm staffed the Republican Party under Ronald Reagan, basically representing the culmination and the ascendance of the Nazi branch of the Republican Party that was set up in the aftermath of World War II. We recently revisited that discussion with John Loftus. Otto von Bolschwing was Eichmann's superior. And not only that superior, but many of Eichmann's immediate subordinates in administering the liquidation of European Jews jumped to the CIA courtesy of the Gehlen organization at the end of World War II. Many of them continued operating in Germany as well. Another article, LaRouche's and Murder in Germany. This concerns a reopening of the investigation into the murder of a fellow named Jerry Duggan, or Duggan, D-U-G-G-A-N. He was a young British student who was opposed to the Iraq War, got involved with the anti-war movement, and very quickly fell under the sway of the LaRouche organization, a fascist cult organization based in Germany with its Schiller Institute. And it appears that once he discovered what this organization was, he started objecting to it, and his mother got a call at 4:30 in the morning saying that he was in serious trouble and was worried that he was going to be killed, or he certainly feared for his life. Later, he was found dead, allegedly from being hit by a car, but the official version of that does not hold water. And this entire article will be available in the description for the record program number 707. I would note that the LaRouche group has made significant inroads in the so-called progressive sector in the United States. A LaRouche Lieutenant Webster Tarpley has become one of the fixtures in the so-called 911 truth movement. Again, these are the creatures advancing the remarkable hypothesis that the World Trade Center was brought down by a controlled demolition and that a cruise missile hit the Pentagon. And people involving themselves with those elements should be aware of the prominence of European or the prominence of neo-fascist elements in that milieu. There are other articles as well, including the NPD, the top German neo-Nazi party, being able to distribute CDs to school children, and also the continued presence of Nazi sympathizers in prominent positions in the German government. However, we will have to talk about those we'll talk about those in the description of For the Record 707. They will be fully annotated. We're out of time, and this concludes For the Record Program 707, update on Eurofascism. This is being recorded on March 28 of the year 2010. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.